Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 66 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. We are on iTunes and other podcast programs. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. Use one of these methods to send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and include your mailing address, and I will send you a little thank you gift. The feedback of the week is from Colin via email. Good morning, David. I've been listening to your podcast for several weeks now and have found them to be very informative. Thanks, Colin, and I'll take your suggestion under advisement, and I love suggestions for future guests from my listeners. And now to our guest for this week. Alice Drager is a professor of clinical medical humanities and bioethics at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. She's author of Hermaphrodites and the Medical Invention of Sex and the 2015 book Galileo's Middle Finger, which we'll spend a lot of time talking about today. Welcome to the show, Professor Drager.
Thanks for having me.
Yes. Now, when I was reading your book, which I found fascinating, I sort of saw that there were two overlapping subjects. One was the whole issue of intersex, and then there was the issue of academic freedom, and they kind of overlap, as your book explains pretty well. But I think that intersex is still something people don't understand very well, don't have a lot of experience with, have a lot of sort of negative reactions to, and especially what you start with, which is what I was calling hermaphrodites, but you imply that that's not the right term anymore. So can you just talk briefly about what a hermaphrodite is, or what they should be called nowadays, and what are some of the controversies about that?
Sure. So the word hermaphrodite goes way back in our culture, and historically what it's meant was a person or a being, it could be an animal, that has both male and female typical traits. So the reason we don't use the term anymore for humans is because it tends to be a pejorative term. So we've taken to using the term intersex instead. So when we talk about intersex in humans, what we're talking about is anything where a person has a type of sex anatomy that they're born with that doesn't fit the standard male or the standard female types. And that may mean that they don't have XX or XY chromosomes, which are the female typical and the male typical type, but they might have something else like XXY or X with no second sex chromosome. They might have XX in some of their cells and XY in others of their cells. But many people with intersex actually have standard XX or XY chromosomes, but they have something else different about their body. So that might be genitals that are different in terms of sex development. It might mean that in their body on the outside has a male typical body, but inside has female traits, or vice versa. So there's lots of different ways that sex can develop in humans, because sex development turns out to be incredibly complicated. And there are at least 36 different conditions we could talk about.
Oh, okay. Right. I don't know if a lot of people understand that the male and female sexual anatomy, actually, it's really the same organs, just developed differently. So if I'm correct, and I'm not an anatomist, that the penis and clitoris are really the same organ, and so there's a continuum in between those, correct? Like a large clitoris, small penis.
Yes, in terms of those organs, and then also the scrotum and the labia majora are the same tissue developmentally, so you can have one or the other or something in between. There are parts that only male, so when we're developing in the womb, we have all the same parts to start with, and then we bifurcate most of the time. One goes down one path or the other in terms of male or female. There are some organs that die away in the male or die away in the female during development. Those are related to what we call the Wolfian or the Mullerian structures. But in terms of the external genitals, yeah, basically we start off with the same tissue, and then we go different directions depending on the hormone levels and depending on whether or not our cells can respond to those hormones. So that means that there can be a lot of different ways that sex can develop. And some of the ways that it develops is what we call ambiguous genitalia, which is sex types that the genitals are between the male and the female type.
Right. And it seems, reading your book, that a principle, I don't know if you stated it explicitly, but you implicitly seem to endorse the principle that it's the individual who should get to choose their gender, because it might not be obvious by looking at them. especially when they're a baby. And yet a lot of people have a problem with that principle. And would you say that that is a principle you endorse?
Well, so gender is a social role and a psychological feeling inside of ourselves, and sex is the body that develops. And so it's easy with stuff like intersex to get the two of them sort of mixed up and blended together. So your question makes sense on one end, and if you think about it another way, it doesn't quite make sense.
Okay.
So all babies are born with sex anatomy, and we assign them a gender, typically as boy or girl. Mm-hmm. What I think and what the intersex rights patient movement argues, and I'm part of that patient rights movement, what we say is that you can assign a child a gender as boy or girl, making a best guess based on the biology. And that's what we do in most cases with all of us, is you look at the child and you say, oh, that looks like a boy, so we're going to raise him as a boy, or looks like a girl.
Right.
With intersex cases, you often have to learn more about the body with some tests to try to figure out which way you think they're going to go. But then we think that the person should not have their sex anatomy disturbed with surgery or hormone treatments that are not medically necessary until they can decide for themselves what they want to do about it. And part of the reason is because sometimes we get gender assignment wrong.
Right.
But the bigger issue is that we think that you shouldn't take risks with a child's body in terms of their sex anatomy without their permission, basically, unless there's some dire medical reason. In some cases, these kids can be born, for example, without an opening for the urination. And that's really critically important to create.
Right.
So that's medically necessary. But in most of the surgeries done on these little kids, it's done purely for social reasons, because they're trying to make them look more like a typical female or more like a typical male. And we know from the accounts of people who've been through this that a lot of times they get the gender wrong, gender assignment wrong, or they leave people with surgical problems,
right.
Scarring, pain, infections. And so we really think it's best to just respect the child and to say, we're going to raise you for now as a boy, and we're going to assume that's the way you're going to go. And we may be wrong, just as with any other child, we could be wrong. And then you're going to decide right. whether or not you want to change your body.
Right. Well, that does make sense, because surgery, if surgery could be easily reversed, it'd be maybe slightly different. But some of the surgeries that you described as being done are not reversible. And so if they get the gender wrong, that's a lifetime problem for that child.
It really is. And there's a whole generation of folks who were males at birth, but were born with small penises, what in the medical literature is called micropenis. And they were sex changed into girls because of the belief that you couldn't grow up with a small penis. And so their testes were taken away. They were given female hormones as they grew up. They were given what's called a neovagina, which is a surgically built vagina. The parts of their penises were cut away to make them look more like clitorises. And a percentage of these folks ended up identifying as male, but they can't have that tissue back, obviously.
Right.
So our feeling is that it's really important that people decide what they want to do with their own tissue. That's not to say you don't do anything. We think very strongly that you should provide psychosocial support, and especially peer support, because we find that helps people tremendously in terms of both the parents and the children. To provide peer support provides a sort of psychological normalization around what's happening, that you're not the only one. You're not a monster. You're not the only person this happens to, and you can live like this.
Yeah, I guess because 99% of the people around you easily fit into the category of male and female, so you would feel alone and wouldn't realize that around the world there are thousands of people, possibly more than that, who have some similarities with you.
There's actually a lot more genital variation among typical males and typical females than we let people know. So even people who have typical male and typical female bodies often feel embarrassed or ashamed about their bodies. I mean, I remember I did. I was very flat-chested until very late. And I remember feeling very much like I was not a real girl, or I wasn't right. an appropriate girl as I was growing up. So, you know, when people say to me, well, what about the locker room? I always remind them we all felt uncomfortable naked in the locker room together. So the solution to that is both education around the fact that bodies differ and that's okay, but also providing privacy for everybody.
Well,
this solution, I think, would be good for everybody.
I was a year younger than most of the children in my class when I was growing up. So you can imagine that when they were all getting into puberty and I was still not quite there, it was pretty embarrassing for me. You know,
I remember my mother did not have a lot of sympathy for me, because I had asked her for a bra, and I remember she said to me, get back to me when you have something to hold up.
<That's>...
You know, she was always very flat-chested, so her attitude was, forget it, good news, you don't need a bra. She was a feminist, and she just didn't care. Her attitude was, this is great, you don't need a bra.
Yes.
And, of course, I was so humiliated, because I was the only girl in, you know, eighth grade without a bra.
Right.
So I remember the locker room being very stressful, and I'm, as far as I know, I have a female typical body.
Yes. Well, I mean, nobody exactly fits the average, and most of the bodies we see in magazines are photoshopped anyway. So, if you actually don't look at real naked bodies, you actually don't know what a naked human body looks like, because what you're seeing as half naked in a magazine is not really true.
It's so very true, and in fact, you know, when my son was about 10 years old, I was railing about people calling vulvas vaginas and how stupid this was and how they should know the difference. And my son asked me, what does a vulva look like? And I realized there was like virtually no way to show him what a vulva looks like, right? Because there's no simple naked bodies in popular culture that I could show him. There's pornography, which I wasn't going to use, partly because it's so freaking unrealistic, right?
Yes. Well, yes.
And, you know, it's not like I was going to show him my own vulva. And finally, I went to an anatomy text from the 1940s, which is where I finally found a picture that was not a sliced away woman, right? Because they do have sliced away pictures, but he wanted to know straight on, what does a woman's, you know, bottom look like? Yes. And so I had to use this text from 1949, because we have so little access to bodies as they really look.
Yes. And of course, that just builds body shame, because every boy believes they've got a small penis deep down.
Yep.
Every woman feels that their vulva is ugly because they actually haven't seen a whole lot.
That's right.
And especially with the other sex, I guess in the locker room you get to see a little bit, but
not much.
Yes, most people are good at hiding it. But so you described you had some issues with the doctors that you, once you started to go to conferences and things like that, because a lot of the doctors were doing this surgery and they maybe weren't so happy that somebody came along and said, we shouldn't be doing it.
No, they weren't happy at all. Their attitude was that I and the other patient rights advocates were being naive. And I should explain. So the way I got into this was, I'm a historian, and the topic was suggested to me looking at the history of hermaphroditism in the history of science and the history of medicine. And I didn't think it happened in humans, but my dissertation director said, no, go look at humans, because it does happen in humans. And I discovered this huge medical literature that was unknown to most of us. And so I started writing histories on it. And the people who had been born with these conditions, who felt they had been abused by the medical system, contacted me. And I ended up joining them, thinking it would only take about 6 months to change the medical system, because it was so out of date. It treated males like penis size was the only thing that mattered, and treated females like reproduction was all that mattered. It was lying to people about their medical histories. So I joined up with the movement, and as we went to these doctors and said, you know, this system is terrible. You're lying to people about their medical histories. You're doing unnecessary genital surgeries. You're sometimes taking away people's fertility out of a Freudian belief that you have to have a big penis to be a real man, or and their attitude was, well, the parents are upset, so we have to absolutely change these kids in order for the parents to bond to their children. And that was very frustrating to me, because I actually ended up studying lots of anomalies in humans, so dwarfism and conjoined twinning and all sorts of anomalies that people are born with. And what I found pretty quickly was that parents actually bond to their children almost no matter what, that in fact, bonding was not the problem for parents. Parents did have social shame issues, but that wasn't being addressed by the surgery. And in fact, when the surgeries were being done, the parents were still left feeling ashamed, but they were then got the message, you can't talk about it because we fixed it.
Right.
And so the parents would sort of bury their shame and have shame around the child. And then they would have secrecy as well, because the children were not being told what had been done to them.
Right.
So it was just such a mess. So it was really hard to convince the surgeons in particular, but also the pediatric endocrinologists, that the system had to change. Today, so 20 years later, their attitudes have changed, but their practices are still largely the same, unfortunately.
Really? One thing you said in the book was, which kind of woke me up, was that in the West we moralize about female genital mutilation, and yet you said that what we're doing here secretly for a lot of children is really no different. We're doing it for different reasons, but it's not really a whole lot better. Maybe it's not better at all than what's being done in some, what we might call primitive societies.
It's done in more sanitary conditions, and insurance pays for it.
Yeah, okay.
So that would be two differences. But it's done for cultural reasons. It's done for the cultural belief that you have to have genitals that look a particular way in order to be accepted as either a male or a female. And in that sense, I think it's really problematic. In fact, The 1995 law that was passed in this country outlawing female genital mutilation actually has an intersex exemption written in, which basically says that if a doctor thinks the child is abnormal, then it's okay to do exactly the same kinds of things they're saying are illegal. So there's actually an exception built into the law specifically meant for intersex kids to say that they're allowed to be subject to the same sorts of, you know, cultural practices, which again are more sanitary here, but are essentially cutting the same tissue, cutting the clitoris, cutting the vagina, right, cutting the labia.
And the term female genital mutilation, whether it, I mean, sanitation doesn't come into that term, that still applies, although in some cases it's male genital mutilation. But
well, I can't call it this because I have to work with the doctors and they get mad at me if I use the phrase, but a lot of the intersex activists who I respect refer to it as intersex genital mutilation. And I personally, I don't find that an unreasonable way to think about it. So there's a study that just came out about 2 weeks ago, actually, looking at hypospadias repair, which is when boys have the urinary opening, the pee hole, not on the end of the penis, but underneath, essentially. And this study that just came out of a very good hospital in Texas admits that 66% of the boys on whom this is done need more surgery because it fails. And it's done to move the penile opening, not because it's medically necessary. They do it to get these boys to piss standing up. And because the idea is if you can't do that, you can't be a real man. Right. The numbers out of that study are horrific. And it's exactly what we've been saying for years, which is that these surgeries done for social reasons have a very high complication rate, a very high risk rate.
Right.
And now in an editorial that accompanied this paper, this surgeon admitted, he said, we've basically been deceiving ourselves and our patients for many years with regard to the complication rate.
And there, I listened to a program recently about a movement in Germany to try to get men to stop peeing standing up because it makes a mess, which often women end up cleaning up. So, and is it really a big deal that if a man has to go into a cubicle to pee as opposed to standing up?
It really it depends on the man. It depends on the social situation. Mm-hmm. I wrote a piece for Pacific Standard called "Do You Have to Pee Standing Up to Be a Real Man?" And in there, I tell the story about one family that I got to know a little bit. And in that family, the boy was born with hypospadias, and the parents I talked with, and they looked at the complication rates, and I was glad they decided against doing the surgery because I was afraid this healthy, happy little kid that they had adopted from another place, that he was going to end up with surgery after surgery after surgery. He had perfect health. He was happy, just a really delightful child. So they decided against it. When the doctors end up telling the parents, you know, but the child will feel that he doesn't urinate the same way as the men in his family, the father decided he would pee standing down, sitting down.
Okay.
All of the men in the family decided they would help this boy by peeing sitting down so that he had no question in his mind that real men pee sitting down.
Right. And, so well, they that's very clever.
Around him. Yeah, no, they totally normalized the situation around him and gave him the message that you can be a happy, loving, real man if you urinate sitting down. And so for the kid, he knows not all men do that, but he also knows all the men in his family do it around him, and so he sees it as kind of normal.
And in those cases, which just shows my ignorance on this matter, I mean, he would ejaculate through the same tube? And
he would, and that does interfere with fertility, but it turns out fertility is quite simple in these cases to fix because they're still ejaculating semen. And so basically, if you want to get a woman pregnant, you just do that, and as I described in this article, you use a turkey baster. So, and I've known men with hypospadias who have done this who actually find it kind of cool because they, in general, they can't get their wives accidentally pregnant because they're ejaculating too high in the vagina to get her pregnant. When they want to get pregnant, then what they do is he ejaculates into a cup, they put it in a turkey baster, he inserts it in her and squeezes, and she gets pregnant that way.
Okay.
It's a really low-tech solution. So it's, you know, I should also mention, I mean, what amazes me is the doctors don't know this, I have to tell them. There's actually a $3 tool that you can buy that's sold to trans men. These are men who were born female but have self-identified as men. It's basically like a little plastic cup that you put in your hand. It's not very visible because you cup it in your hand. You just put it under your crotch, and if you want to pee standing up, you just hold it in your hand, put it under your crotch, and you can pee into a urinal. These were actually invented for women for camping. They're called go girls, and it's a thing you can stick in your pocket. You pull it out, you can pee into it, and it shoots the urine straight forward. So you can actually use this, and as long as somebody doesn't stare at your crotch, they'll think that you have a penis and you're peeing out of the tip of the penis.
Right, right. Okay, I understand. Now, one more question before we move on to transgender is, Do a lot of parents have a feeling that their children can't have a normal sex life if they don't have normal anatomy? And what is the experience of some of these people who have mixed, you know, who are unchanged and grow up with mixed anatomy?
The fear is definitely among the parents that the children won't have a normal sex life. And what the reason they're worried about that is something bigger, which is the fear that their children won't be lovable. And that's actually a fear that all parents have for all children, but it becomes very acute when you have a child born with an anomaly that doesn't fit the social norms. There's an intense parental fear that the child will be seen as unlovable by other people. So even though the parents very much love their children, they have what I think is not an unreasonable fear. What we know from the folks who have grown up without surgeries, who've had these kinds of genital anomalies in particular, is that it does take more talking with your partner and working with partners in terms of figuring out how everything works and explaining that things are not the same. And not every partner is going to be into that. But what we know is that partners do tend to be particular about what kinds of genitals they're interested in. That's one of the reasons we bifurcate people into gay, straight, and bi, genitals do matter to people. And it can introduce some degree of stress and need for preparation. And so one of the things we recommend is that, especially as folks become teenagers, that they have access to good sex therapists who can help them think about how to talk about those issues, how to work with the genitals that they do have. And some of them will elect for genital surgery. But I must say that of the ones who've elected for genital surgery themselves, I often hear from them that they regret it and that they wish that they had taken more seriously how intense it is to have your genitals subject to surgery.
Yes, yes. Yeah, because once you decide it's wrong, there's no going back.
Although we do know from studies of surgery in general that it's always better when you choose surgery for yourself, that the outcomes that are reported are better if people choose for themselves. We don't have data specifically for that with genital surgery, but we have data from surgery in general that people report better outcomes when they're able to decide for themselves what they're going to have in terms of surgery.
Right. So let's move on. You talk about a man named J. Michael Bailey and transsexualism. He wrote a book or a paper called The Man Who Would Be Queen, The Science of Gender Bending and Transsexualism. And these are people who have normal chromosomes and normal anatomy, but inside themselves they feel that they were born in the wrong gender. And he got in trouble with a concept that he called autogynephilia. So can you describe, put this in context, and why it was so controversial?
Sure. Bailey was actually relying on the work of a sex researcher named Ray Blanchard in Toronto. And Bailey is a professor at Northwestern, a psychology professor. And he was looking at Blanchard's work on specifically males who become females. So Blanchard was looking at hundreds of men who had come into his clinic looking for sex reassignment surgery, or what today we call gender affirming surgeries. And Blanchard noted what had sort of been hinted at in the clinical literature before, that this population actually bifurcated into two types of folks demographically. One were people who were very effeminate as boys, as young boys, and they were always identified as being very girly. They used to call them sissy boys. So they were typically interested in girl-typical toys, girl-typical play games, et cetera, et cetera, right. Sometimes wanting to dress up as girls, maybe even declaring that they were girls. And that they were, as they grew up, exclusively attracted to men. So they were what sex researchers would call androphilic. That means attracted to male types. And what Blanchard found was that he decided to call this group homosexual transsexuals, although I find the term really confusing because when they transition, they become straight women, socially speaking.
Right.
So that was the one category. The other category, which was the controversial one, is the category that Blanchard termed autogynephilia. And these were boys who were pretty male typical as children. They tended to be into male typical games, male typical interests. And as they grew up, they tended to go into male typical professions like engineering and math professions and these kinds of things. They also tended to marry women and have children with women often. But then they felt that there was this sort of overwhelming feeling in themselves that they should be female, and that was tied up with an erotic feeling. And so when they were cross-dressing specifically for sexual arousal purposes. So the term autogynephilia means auto, which is self, gyna, attracted to females, philia, so love of females, self-directed attraction to oneself as a woman, which sounds really strange, but I actually think all sexual orientation sounds strange when you look at them carefully.
Yes.
So autogynephilic transsexuals would be born male, but sexually aroused by the idea of being or becoming women, to the point where they really felt as if their orientation was screwed up by having a male body. And so they were seeking transition to really draw out the female aspects of themselves and be able to present socially as women, because that made more sense for them in terms of their own sense of self. Right. And so Blanchard supported transition for both types, as long as they were screened and you were sure there wasn't something else going on that was causing the distress. Mm-hmm. And supported transition for both types, as Bailey does. But the second type was very controversial, because what some transgender activists said was that it painted them as perverts and so made them look like they weren't really transgender. But in fact, both Bailey and Blanchard support the idea that these are legitimate ways to be transgender. They just think that it's the more accurate story in terms of the origins.
Right. Well, I don't think I've ever told anybody this, but when I was I must have been a very young child, I used to have a dream that when I got to a certain age, I was going to turn into a girl. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't upsetting to me at all. Like, I thought, I guess it was almost erotic in my feeling, even though I think I was pre-sexual at the time. And, you know, then it sort of passed as I went through puberty and stuff like that. But, you know, I guess it's like, you know, men like porn with two women making out. I mean, sexuality is a complicated thing, and what turns people on is not always easy to say.
It is very complicated. And, you know, what I say to people is, like, I've gotten to the point where I think sexuality is like knees. If you look closely at any knee, it looks bizarre. But everybody has them. Everybody's are different, and they're all kind of weird. And I think the same is true with straight-up heterosexuality and homosexuality and everything, that if you look at it closely, you start wondering, well, where did that come from, and how do you get that way? And I don't think we have good answers to that. So one of the points that both Bailey and Blanchard made that, again, was controversial was that people who transition are just on the far end of a spectrum, where there might be people who have the same feelings, but for whatever reason, they don't need to transition. So some will need to transition to be psychologically well, and some won't. Some, for example, for some people who are autogynephilic, just cross-dressing now and then is enough to sort of give you a sense of wholeness and satisfaction sexually, and a sense of well-being. So people will vary in terms of what they need from the clinical spectrum. And that was controversial, because the transgender movement has tended to have this very simplistic idea about gender, which is you're either born one or the other, and you know right from the start which one you are, and eventually, if you're lucky, you tell everybody what you are. But gender for a lot of us, and certainly sexuality for a lot of us, seems to be more subtle and more complicated than that.
Right. Like, I mean, even a heterosexual couple that, you know, likes to sort of change the stereotypical gender roles sometimes while having sex, like the woman dominant, the male submissive, something like that. I mean, that's sort of a small example of that that would be considered normal, although, again, like, it's done in the privacy of a bedroom. So if people knew you did that, some people might be shocked, right?
Well, it didn't used to be considered normal, and for a lot of people, it's still not considered normal. So there's this whole movement, for example, within parts of the Christianity in America that is very much about females always being submissive, including sexually, and men always being dominant. Right. So sexuality has always been contentious. I've really, after studying sexuality, I've come to believe that people don't choose what turns them on. And in general, once you're an adult, you can't change what turns you on. And so it's all, for me, it's just a question of consent. I don't really care what people are into, as long as they're doing it with a consenting adult, or if they want to do it on their own, that's cool too. And so I get frustrated when people want to say, you know, that's normal or that's abnormal. My attitude is, we're all abnormal.
Exactly.
So let's just talk about consent.
It's like our bodies. There is no such thing as the normal human body. There's just a people who are closer to average or further away. But another aspect of the Bailey story was how he was attacked, not really so much why he was attacked, but you felt that the attacks on him were really unfair. And so what were some of the things said about him that got you involved with this issue?
When I set out to look at his story, I really thought it was going to be kind of a he said, she said story. I thought it would be he was a sort of white, heterosexual, male, you know, privileged kind of clod who just wouldn't understand how he offended the transgender community, and that the transgender activists just wouldn't understand his sort of obsession with science, and that he doesn't care what's politically correct, he cares what's true, etc. But as I went into it for a whole year of research and ended up interviewing over 100 people and looking at thousands of sources, what I found was that the people who charged him with various unethical things, including making up research, having sex with a transsexual research subject, allegedly when she was his research subject, doing research without appropriate informed consent, that in fact those charges were not true, and that there were reason to believe that the people who made the charges knew that they weren't true, but that what they were trying to do was kill the messenger of autogynephilia. Blanchard had put his work out there and had talked about this, but it had been sort of limited to the scientific literature, and so people didn't really know very much about it. It wasn't a threat at all to this population. Right. But Bailey's book was very much a popularization. It was very readable, very lively, very well written, and so it had the potential to really bring it to the masses, and I think that's why they went after him and tried to take him down. And I show in the book that, in fact, the main people who came after him actually have histories that would seem to demographically at least a couple of them, put them in the category. In fact, one of the people who came after them, I had a letter given to me by somebody to whom she had written it, saying that she admitted to her own autogynephilia, and she was kind of exploring what did it mean. And so there they had come after Bailey, claiming autogynephilia was not true and it was false, and yet their own work showed that they had agreed with him, that in fact that's what their history showed. And by the way, I should say, I see absolutely no shame in autogynephilia. The problem may be, in fact, that the general population can't stand the idea that transgender isn't just about gender, it's also about sexuality. But I think that's the problem that we have to re-educate people and get them to understand that for almost all of us, gender and sexuality are tied up, and they get complicated connections to each other.
Yes, and we get very uncomfortable when we're a little bit insecure in our own sexuality. I remember the first time I was approached by a homosexual man who was interested in me, I just didn't know what to do. I like froze. What am I supposed to do? And maybe part of me was thinking, well, maybe I do have a little bit of attraction, you know, maybe I'm not heterosexual. There's a lot of fear involved, and just not knowing how to handle a situation. But I think you describe well that it was kind of one of these things where the end justifies the mean, and if they were going to bring him down, they were going to use every tactic necessary, whether it was honest or not.
That's exactly right, and that's how they went after him. And it was scary for me because, I mean, they had gone after his children, after his girlfriend, after his colleagues, tried to take him down in terms of his job. When I did the research, I had at that point given up tenure because I was both running the Intersex Society and I'd had a child and I had too much going on. So I was working for Northwestern part-time without tenure. You know, I had a child of my own at that point. I had the intersex rights movement working with me, and a lot of my work, you know, was at risk if these people came after me because of the way that all sexual and gender issues get tied up together in terms of politics. And so when I had to go and publish it, I was really quite scared. And in fact, they did come after me. And that's why this book ended up existing, was because they came after me and I had two choices, one of which was to hide and the other one was to try to find other people to whom the same thing had happened. And that's what I did. I ended up wandering around the country finding other researchers who'd been attacked by over identity politics issues and trying to understand sort of how do we work this out, because I was sympathetic to the activists, having been one myself for many years, but also really sympathetic to the researchers.
Right. And you describe that some of the activists kind of changed sides, like they'd actually cooperated with Bailey for some time in the development of his book, but then people got to them, and then they sort of changed sides. But then after a while, they sort of got a little disturbed about the attacks and didn't want anything to do with it. Is that about a...
Yeah, and I mean, one of them referred to basically being told she was going to be lynched, not literally, but in terms of on the internet, that if she didn't cooperate in terms of going after Bailey, that she was going to be lynched. And so she turned on Bailey, although eventually those people turned again on her, and so she ended up feeling very disenfranchised by the whole scene, understandably. So yeah, it was quite ugly. And some of those people I had known previously because they had been supporters of the intersex rights movement.
Right.
And so it was very much a sort of small town horror situation as far as I was concerned.
Yes.
And they did come after my reputation and effectively took over my Google rankings for a couple of years and made it, if you Googled me during those years, what you would find was that I was a transphobe. I wanted to put intersex people in the gas chambers, that my family was Catholic and I was secretly carrying out a Catholic agenda, that my sister is in fact a nun. They conflated the two of us and sort of came after me that way. Wow. They filed an ethics charge against me when my husband dared to make a joke about it. They filed an ethics charge against him. I think I may be the only person in history ever charged with an ethics violation for admitting to having sex with my own husband, but that was a complicated story. It was so crazy. I mean, the whole scene was just so crazy and so uncomfortable. Yeah, I used to say to people, as I was interviewing other researchers, I found that there were two solutions people found. One was to exercise way too much, and the other one was to drink way too much. And I would say to people, I don't see why you have to choose. Yes.
Well, I'm into doing both, so.
Yeah, I was doing both for a while, too. Yes. Now I exercise more than I drink. But I mean, it is funny because I took up running during the Bailey thing to try to burn up the stress. Right. And when I got into the Chagnon stuff, the anthropology, I don't know if you want to talk about
yes,
that.
Yes, I would like to. Actually, that's my next question.
So I took up swimming. And then when I got to the dexamethasone stuff, I took up biking. And so now I do triathlons because of all the stress. And, you know, it's funny because when you do them, you people think, oh, these people are so self-righteous and such good athletes. And when you talk to people, they all have the same backstories. I'm totally stressed out. That's why I do this.
Okay, so that's...
The pathology of the triathletes.
Yes. I have never been able to do that. I've never had the... I like to climb mountains, but, well, not really climb them, but get to the top of them, which using any means necessary. But that gets me away from the city, which I think is what I'm trying to really do. So anyway... the Yanomamo.
are a
tribe in Brazil, the Amazon?
Yeah, they're actually where Brazil and Venezuela meet.
Okay. And so Chagnon was studying them for a long time. And what did he get why did he get attacked, and what did he get attacked over with his studies?
He started studying the Yanomamo as an anthropologist in the 1960s when he himself was a young man just out of graduate school. But the attacks on him came in the year 2000, and they came because a self-styled journalist named Patrick Tierney wrote a book called Darkness in El Dorado, which was published by Norton and to much high praise. And he also published an article in The New Yorker based on it at the same time. And what Tierney claimed was that both Chagnon and his collaborator, the geneticist James Neal, in 1968 had sort of purposely started a measles epidemic among the Yanomama, allegedly using a bad vaccine in order to test a eugenical theory to see who would live and who would die, and that they refused medical care. This was actually all false, but the reason the story was able to take off was because the American Anthropological Association, which we call the AAA, the AAA allowed Tierney to run with this with the assistance of a couple of liberal cultural anthropologists who hated Chagnon because Chagnon supported sociobiology, which is the idea that we have inborn human behaviors and inborn social systems. And they came after Chagnon. Neal was dead at that point. He had just died of cancer. But they came after Chagnon for two solid years. And the research I ended up doing on that ended up showing that actually the leaders in the AAA knew that Tierney's book was wrong and was false. But the reason they went after Chagnon was to sort of do this demonstration internationally that anthropology cares about indigenous peoples and that we don't appreciate, you know, rude white men going into indigenous tribes and causing harm. And so they kind of held Chagnon up as a scapegoat and really ruined his life in many ways. He ended up really a very isolated psychologically and socially to some degree. And it was quite shocking. There were a couple, before I came along, there were several anthropologists who had looked into it and shown that the book was wrong. But the whole scene persisted. The AAA, in spite of a membership vote that said that they would rescind the report on it because it was false, the AAA leadership left the report up on the website as if it was still stood. The report included claims that Chagnon had paid his subjects to kill each other, which was absolutely not true. So it was quite an extraordinary scene. And the reason I found that story particularly interesting among all the ones I looked at was because of the way that liberal academia tends to follow its ideology rather than follow the facts. And this was one of those cases where that happened. I should say that a bunch of scientific societies looked into Tierney's claims and immediately denounced them as false. So the American Academy of Sciences, the National Genetics Group, all sorts of groups had looked into this and found Tierney's book to be false. They found clear evidence that the measles epidemic that was at issue had predated them coming into the field that year, that the vaccine that Neal brought was in fact a safe vaccine and that they tried very hard. They had tapes from the period showing that they had in fact tried to race ahead of the epidemic and vaccinate people as quickly as possible because they knew the epidemic was taking off. Neil had been coming into the field with the vaccines because he knew eventually they would get measles. It was clear that they were getting too much human contact in a way that was they were vulnerable. So he actually had the vaccinations ready with him, but he was a little bit too late. So what was interesting was the AAA stood out from all these other organizations and very much made a big liberal identity politics show of it and hung up Chagnon, didn't invite him to defend himself or anything for 2 years.
It seemed that part of Chagnon's problem was that he described negative traits of the Yanomami, like they fought each other, it was like normal human beings. They weren't perfect, and he described how like infidelity, things like that, which sometimes I think we want to believe that all native tribes lived in perfect harmony prior to.
Right. Perfect harmony, never disturb the environment, et cetera, yes. Et cetera. Right. Yeah. No. And Chagnon was one of the anthropologists showing that that was a myth, that this myth of the noble savage was just a myth. And that, in fact, they were like the rest of us, that they fart and they belch and they fornicate and they take drugs and they steal women and they start wars with each other, you know. And I mean, basically, from his point of view, he was showing that humans are humans. But from the point of view of the liberal anthropologists, he was portraying the Yanomami as if they were somehow subhuman. It's funny because Chagnon doesn't see that at all as subhuman. He sees that as human. But the claim was that, you know, this was supposed to show that they were subhuman and that somehow he had fed the government's campaigns against the Yanomami down there, which I think is ridiculous. The governments down there that invaded the Yanomami territory did so because there's gold in the area, did so because they wanted the precious minerals, not because they wanted to suppress a tribe that might be violent. I mean, these folks, yes, they're violent. Lots of people are violent. But that's not why the governments went into that area. The governments went into the area because of money.
yes. Corrupt politicians, businessmen, and just the overpowering desire for easy money, I guess.
And that was actually part of what surprised me when in the book I talk about when I started looking into who was Tierney, because everybody had focused on Chagnon, but people were not asking the question, well, who's Patrick Tierney? And I end up getting a manuscript of his that had never been published in which he confessed to doing all sorts of horrific stuff in that very area, including going in without proper quarantine, which can create disease outbreaks, bringing illegal shotguns into the area. And in fact, pretending to be a gold miner, using false identity papers, tricking people, and in fact bringing mercury into the rainforest, which is one of the things the gold miners do as part of his disguise. So I was shocked to discover that this guy who had accused Chagnon and Neil of all sorts of ethical atrocities had actually documented his own ethical problems, but nobody had bothered to look into that.
I think it's quite normal to accuse people of what you're actually guilty of to help cover it up.
Yes.
And the missionaries played a role too. I mean, was that part of the attack on Chagnon? Because I mean, the impact on missionaries on native people has often been really negative in the past.
Yeah, Chagnon for years had accused the missionaries of actually being the source of a lot of the problems that the Yanomami were facing, both in terms of disease, but also disruption of their culture. And to some degree, that was true, although Chagnon's own chief collaborator, Ray Hames, has said that Chagnon overplays the problems that the missions have caused. So they actually have argued among themselves to what degree the missions are a problem. But certainly the missions are one of the cultural disruptions that occur down there. And Chagnon was very critical of them. And so there is good evidence that, in fact, the Catholic Salesians, who were the main missionaries down there, had come after Chagnon and had, for example, put together a packet of information which smeared Chagnon and had anonymously distributed them at earlier AAA meetings, and that Tierney was affiliated with them, which I discovered from reading his own accounts and interviewing people, that Tierney was actually a Catholic associated with the Catholics. And so when Chagnon first told me that this was all part of a Catholic persecution, I thought he was having a Galileo fantasy.
Right.
Because Chagnon is a very, shall we say, grand figure who has a lot of grand ideas. And I thought he was kind of under a delusion. But the more I looked into it, the more I thought, holy crap, he's actually right. The Catholics come after him. So that
I mean, it makes sense, right? I mean, there's a lot of criticism of the missionaries. And having a person who's in opposition to you in the field where you want to work undisturbed, I guess getting rid of him would have seemed like a good thing for the Catholic missionaries.
Indeed, indeed. And, you know, I think a number of the missionaries really tried to do good and did some good there in terms of trying to provide health care in particular. But as with any other situation, missionaries are complicated institutions. Yes. And can certainly do some harm.
You also talked about Margaret Mead. I won't go into that, but I remember hearing the criticisms of Margaret Mead, and I just kind of accepted it because it was published, but you showed that was also mostly based on lies, maybe entirely. But I'm not sure I have time to discuss that, so I'd like to go and talk about Dr. Maria New and this drug called dexamethasone. So this is going back to intersex in a way that she believed that this drug could stop a female fetus from developing intersex. Is that correct?
Yeah, this involved a particular population. So I mentioned earlier that there's at least 36 different kinds of intersex conditions we could talk about. Mm. There's one called, well, there's actually multiple types, but one called congenital adrenal hyperplasia, or CAH. And congenital means inborn. Adrenal right. refers to the glands in the backs of our bodies that make androgens, which is a type of hormone. Most of the reason the androgens work the way they do is for health reasons. They keep us healthy. And then hyperplasia means essentially overgrowing. And so in the case of female fetuses, what that can mean is that they can accidentally masculinize in the womb. The reason is androgens are a masculinizing hormone. So even though males and females both have adrenal glands, males masculinize in the womb because they also have testes making androgens. And so they have a higher level of androgens. In general, in human development, the higher the level of androgens, the more male typical you'll be. The low level of androgens, the more female typical you'll be.
Right.
So in cases of congenital adrenal hyperplasia, what happens is you have a female who has too high a level of androgens. And that can lead to the fetus turning into a baby that can be born actually male typical in terms of masculine development genitally. Inside, they'll have a uterus and ovaries, but outside, they'll look very male. Or they could be in between, so they could be very intersex in terms of genital development. Or they can actually also develop female typical. So there's a whole range among those girls,
right.
Or I should say females.
But one of the things you point out is that you don't know for sure that this is the case. And I think you said, like, based on genetics, it's like 1 out of 8. If the parents have the genes, then there's like 1 out of 8 chance, or maybe less than that, that there will be a problem.
Yeah, so if the parents are both carriers, this is an autosomal recessive. So that means if the parents are both carriers, then on average, one out of four of their children will have congenital adrenal hyperplasia. It's a serious endocrine disorder, and it requires medical treatment because you can have health problems with it.
Right.
In the boys, though, it doesn't lead to intersex development. In the girls, it can. And so if you take 1 out of 4 and then you take only the girls, you get 1 out of 8. So in these families, 1 out of 8 of the kids may be a female born with atypical genitals. And so Dr. New and other endocrinologists decided that the steroid dexamethasone, if given very early in pregnancy, could interrupt this high level of androgens and cause the girls to be born female typical. And shockingly, they decided to pick this up after only one case done without a placebo control in France reported in 1985. They did it on one fetus and said, oh, she looked pretty female typical. That must have worked, which is so incredibly unscientific.
Well, but don't some of those children actually turn out normal even if they have the gene?
Yes, which is why this is shockingly
right.
unscientific. But nevertheless, endocrinologists all over the world who believe that being born intersex is the worst thing that can possibly happen to you ended up offering these families who they picked up either because they'd had a previous child born or they knew it ran in the family or because they had genetic counseling for some reason.
Right.
They found out the parents were carriers. They offered these parents this intervention. And as soon as the woman knew she was pregnant, she was given dexamethasone, which is this steroid that is a glucocorticoid that crosses the placental barrier. It's used because it can change fetal development. It's used specifically to change fetal development, which is also pretty shocking because it's very unusual for us to institute a drug designed to change fetal development. The one we've done in terms of public health is folic acid, which we've used specifically
right.
to try to prevent neural tube defects.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know of harm that comes from that. Glucocorticoids, the animal studies indicated that, in fact, it can lead to very unpredictable development, including in terms of the brain development. But what happened with Maria New is that she pushed this quite hard on families saying that it had been found safe and effective. And then at the same time was actually taking NIH, National Institutes of Health funding to see if it was safe and using the people who she had put through this system retrospectively to study them to see whether or not in fact it had been safe. Although whether or not she was even using them, it's sort of unclear to me because there's very little publication out of her work. But she was doing this, what I think of as sort of bait and switch, which is tell the parents it's safe, advertise it as safe, push it on them as safe, and then get NIH funding and say, I need funding to see if this is really safe.
Right. I got that part of it. It's like it's research, it's not research. It's research, it's not research based on where, you know, who you're talking to or what time. But what are some of the problems that are there problems that are being associated with the use of what's called DEX?
We don't know for sure because in fact her research is so bad and has been so spotty and so selective. We don't actually know what happened with her population. What we do know though is a group in Sweden studied it more appropriately. They enrolled parents prospectively, meaning before the pregnancy occurred, right. And they followed those children continuously. And they didn't do it with placebo, which would have been more scientific, but they did compare them to other children who were not exposed to dexamethasone in the womb. And what that study has found, it's a small study. They studied only 43 children in terms of the dexamethasone exposure. They found a mental retardation rate of 7%, which is about 10 times the normal population rate of mental retardation. They also found almost 1 in 5 have a major medical problem. And my fear is that it's going to turn out that the Swedes are right, that in fact giving dexamethasone very early in pregnancy is incredibly dangerous. And yes. What's sad is that 7 out of 8 of the fetuses who were exposed never even had the condition being targeted, which was the intersex development. So that's the females with CAH. And that means almost 90% of the kids who were exposed to the harms of this never had any chance to benefit. And it wasn't going to prevent the disease of CAH. They're still born with the disease. This was just to prevent intersex development. It's not to save the child's life. We use dexamethasone sometimes, although doctors use betamethasone more now because dexamethasone's been shown to be harmful. But it's used sometimes in second or third trimester if a woman's going into labor too early. They need to try to get the fetus's lungs to mature fast so the child can survive when it's born.
My son might have had that because it's exactly the situation. He was born 6 weeks early and they gave him a steroid to mature his lungs.
And it does seem to improve survivability. But there, the fear is the child's going to die. So of course you're taking a risk, right? Of course you're taking a significant risk because otherwise the baby's going to die. Right. But even there, they've shied away from using dexamethasone because it's been shown even in that population to cause more problems, including what appear to be cognitive problems. And they're using betamethasone more.
I think the only problem I can see with my son is that some of his adult teeth didn't come in. It's pretty hard to connect that together. There is one other drug, interestingly. You mentioned some of the good things that science did, and you mentioned the first AIDS drug, which is AZT. And that's actually a drug that crosses the placenta, and it's used because it crosses the placenta, and the mode of operation of that drug is to interfere with DNA synthesis. And women who refuse to take that drug often have their children taken away from them. So I think it might even be worse than dexamethasone, even though the average AIDS doctor doesn't think so. We've sort of gone away from the thalidomide era where everything during pregnancy is a problem. Now we're just throwing, antidepressants are given during pregnancy and a whole bunch of things, and we're discovering all of these problems.
I agree with you. I think it's remarkable, and I'm not sure why the FDA doesn't care more about making sure that everybody who is pregnant and taking a prescription drug is in a study, because there's a lot of things we simply don't know about how it affects fetal development. You're right. It is as if we've forgotten thalidomide, we've forgotten DES. It's like there's a historical amnesia where these things are concerned, and I find it quite shocking and disturbing.
We're getting towards the end of our time, but two things that I got out of your book at a higher level is first of all, these were fights of liberals versus liberals and often over sexual matters. And I can understand, right-wing conservatives going after scientists, like they're going after Planned Parenthood for the supposed, sale of fetal tissue or whatever. But here you've got basically liberals against liberals, and they're supposed to be above this kind of stuff. So I found the whole thing interesting from that perspective.
and disturbing to me because I'm a liberal. So
well, I feel
what a setting. It's so much nicer to tell a story about right wingers being awful.
I know. I feel exactly the same way. But I think every liberal should read this book just to get a little bit of humility that we're not really better, and that like deep down, we're animals. And if you sort of activate the wrong things, we can go crazy and do horrible things to other people, even if it's only doing horrible things with words and not actually violence. The other thing that I found interesting was that there didn't seem to be a lot of money involved. I'm very used to like scientific controversy where there's big money, say in cancer research, and you might criticize something, but you know, like if you criticize mammography, you're talking about millions or hundreds of millions of dollars in mammograms and radiology fees. But in this case, it didn't seem to be a huge amount of money involved in these disputes that you document.
Yeah, no, I was surprised about that too. I think that is our tendency, is to think that greed is what drives people. And certainly there was money involved, and I think I underestimated perhaps in the book the degree to which maybe money had been motivating Maria New to some extent. But I think in many cases, motivation is more complicated than that. People mm-hmm. are motivated by good intentions. They're motivated by doing good, by being seen as doing good, by being right. And for a lot of the people that I document in the book, the money is not motivation. The money is personal identity issues. And I hope what people take away from it is not the lesson that, you know, there are good and there are evil people and we should be on the good side, but rather that there are a lot of good people who do a lot of bad things and we should really police ourselves much more carefully.
Well, I guess the color for this book would be gray, right? Because there's a gray area between just about everything. Between sexes and between good bad behaviors, and I think that's what made me think a lot reading this book, is it opened my eyes to a lot of the complexities of various types of intersex, transsex, but also more types of academic attacks on each other by people who should have been above all of that.
Yes, absolutely. Complexity is, I think, the lesson, and trying to look more carefully at things and not assume things break down into black and white.
Yes.
I certainly have trouble looking at any controversy anymore in any way that makes me feel good.
Yes.
I always feel like I must be missing 90% of what's here.
Yes. There's more to it, and people are simplifying one side or the other. So is there a website for this book, or should people just go on to a... Yeah.
If you go to my website, which is alicedreger.com, you can find lots of stuff on the book there, including links and to buy it. And it's available also in ebook form and in audiobook form and written. And it should be out in paperback in the spring, but right now it's out in hardback.
Okay, well, thank you so much for talking to me today. Really,
thanks, David. This was great.
Yes, and I'll send you a link to the MP3. And I'd like to thank my audience for listening to yet another episode of The Infectious Myth. Goodbye for now.